This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Hayes Wuhim, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The United Nations warns a new spiral of escalating violence in the Central African Republic is threatening to wipe out progress made since 2013 toward peace and reconciliation.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details next.
Also, at least 44 migrants, including women and babies, have been found dead in northern Niger. And the UN says continued drought, insecurity, and disease outbreaks are worsening the humanitarian crisis in Somalia.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, the United Nations warns a new spiral of escalating violence in the Central African Republic is threatening to wipe out progress made since 2013 toward peace and reconciliation. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Renewed fighting between Christian anti-Balaka militia and the ex-Seleka Muslim rebels in mid-May continues to take a heavy toll. The United Nations reports more than 100,000 people have fled their homes. More than 100 have been killed and hundreds of others wounded. The UN's humanitarian coordinator for CAR, Najat Rushdie, says the peace dividend people were beginning to enjoy has all but disappeared. She warns worse lies ahead if the humanitarian and protection needs of the people continue to be forgotten by the international community.
Today they face the imminent risk that their communities, the entire country, slide back into the abyss of conflict and violence, causing new suffering and jeopardizing all fragile gains and peace dividend.
Rushdie says the international community urgently needs to step up its support. She says money is desperately needed to provide humanitarian aid to millions of people in the CAR living on the knife's edge. She warns little time is left to stabilize the situation in the country.
Otherwise, a last window of opportunity risks being shut very soon. And the armed groups will fill the vacuum and gain more legitimacy, gain more power. But then it means that we abandon the population and we abandon the communities to be the hostage of those armed groups.
Rushdie says half of the country's population of 5 million depends on international aid for survival. She says 2 out of 3 people do not have access to safe drinking water, basic sanitation, or health care. She says the CAR's children have some of the highest levels of chronic malnutrition in the world. The UN official notes aid agencies are unable to provide the needed help because the United Nations has received only 25% of its $400 million humanitarian appeal. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
At least 44 migrants, including women and babies, have been found dead in northern Niger after their vehicle broke down in the desert. Most of the migrants were from Ghana. They apparently died of thirst. Officials say 6 survivors were found. The bodies were found near the remote town of Agadez, which is on a major smuggling route leading to Libya. Last month, soldiers in northern Niger rescued about 40 migrants who had been abandoned in the desert by people smugglers. It is believed they were from the Gambia, Nigeria, Guinea, Senegal, and Niger. Officials say they were trying to reach Libya in hopes of crossing the Mediterranean to Europe. The International Organization for Migration says people smuggling is a $35 billion a year industry. In other news on Niger, the AP quotes a Red Cross worker as saying extremists attacked a border area near Mali, killing 40 people, including 6 soldiers.
An American aid agency says it has put 2 workers on temporary paid leave following allegations they sexually exploited refugees in Greece. The 2 are employed by Mercy Corps AFP reports Greek officials are investigating the case, and the European Commission says it's taking the matter very seriously. It has suspended funding for the agency for the time being. Mercy Corps is one of the many NGOs in Greece helping thousands of refugees, most of whom come from Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq.
Efforts to contain the Ebola outbreak in remote northern DRC appear to be successful so far. No new cases have been reported and the number of suspected cases is small. Four deaths have been reported in Boswell province. Alison Clement Hunt is a spokesperson for the World Health Organization regarding outbreaks and emergencies. She spent the past week in the Ebola zone. She gave VOA's Jody Capua an update on the outbreak.
So the latest situation is that we're still at two confirmed cases of Ebola and three probable. We haven't had any new confirmed cases since the 11th of May. So then we're left with 12 suspect cases. All other suspect cases have now been declared negative by laboratory testing. If this continues and the rest of the suspect cases are negative, then it would appear that the outbreak is tailing off. But we have to keep up very rigorous surveillance until we can be sure of that.
How did the WHO and various health officials contain the outbreak?
We have a combination here of environment and response. The environment is incredibly remote, and I can attest to that. We're talking very dense equatorial forest. To get between the different areas is not easy. So, in fact, even to move suspect cases, for example, to a treatment unit would often not be feasible. So, therefore, in some ways, there could be a self-limiting effect that we've seen in previous outbreaks where the virus can't spread very easily, especially once people are ill. However, the other important factor is just the speed of the response. The Congolese authorities tested rapidly and then alerted WHO and other partners that there was an outbreak. This made it possible to respond quickly and to start following up, getting an emergency interagency emergency team out to the field with the Ministry of Health to start following up contacts and suspect cases. And in fact, the number of contacts now has come down dramatically as well to just 72 contacts still needing to be followed. That's down from over 500 on 600 initially.
Any idea how the first person became infected? Is it assumed that this person somehow either came in contact with bushmeat or ate bushmeat?
I wouldn't like to speculate, but certainly it seems to have been someone who would have been hunting. And again, was out in a remote area. So that would probably be a working hypothesis, yes.
So what happens now? Is it just a matter of wait and see to see whether the epidemic burns itself out?
Absolutely not. It's really important at this point to be extremely proactive. So we've made sure that all the small health centres dotted around the province are aware of how to recognise a suspect case. So every day, even now, there are regular alerts come in and then followed up by the different teams who go out to these areas and check on any potential suspect cases. And that's absolutely key to a rigorous surveillance system. Meanwhile, the epidemiological tracing is going on. There's epidemiologists working out there, biologists working there to trace exactly where this came from, where it spread to, and to see the trajectory of it. Because by understanding that, it can also mean that there could be a really rigorous examination of the chain of transmission to check that everyone who could possibly have been in that loop in any way or in contact has been found, has been seen, has been checked, and is not at risk or is not at risk of spreading the disease further.
So how long will you monitor those contacts, those people who may have been in contact with someone who was infected?
June the 2nd, which is tomorrow, is the date at which the last of the contacts will come out of their 21-day follow-up period. Now, that doesn't mean that we declare the outbreak over by any means. It's just that it means the contacts have been followed up for the required period, have been checked regularly.
Alison Clements-Hunt is a spokesperson for the World Health Organization from Kisangani, Northern DRC. She spoke to VOA's Jody Kapua.
Scientists have tweaked a powerful antibiotic called vancomycin so it is once more potent against life-threatening bacterial infections. Antibiotic resistance has become an urgent global public health problem, and experts say revamping existing antibiotics is an important advance. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
The overuse and misuse of antibiotics to treat common bacterial infections has led to a growing problem of antibiotic resistance around the world. Illnesses once successfully treated with wonder drugs no longer respond to them, endangering the lives of patients. In addition to trying to come up with new antibiotics that pathogens are sensitive to, researchers are working to retool existing drugs. The latest success story comes out of the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla, California, where scientists modified vancomycin, a drug that was invented 60 years ago and considered a last resort against many bacterial illnesses. They made a key change to its molecular structure, interfering with how the bacterium Enterococcus makes protective cell walls. In a study published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, investigators describe how the change made vancomycin 1,000 times more effective against both drug-resistant enterococci bacteria and the original forms of the microorganism. The director of the Office of Antimicrobial Resistance at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, Georgia, is Jean Patel.
Modifying vancomycin and now making it a drug that's active even against bacteria that were previously resistant is helpful. It means that we have the potential to make the most of an old drug and to revitalize that old drug.
In a report on antimicrobial resistance, the World Health Organization called it a profound threat to human health. Patel says it's hard to get a handle on the exact extent of the problem because many countries do not have adequate laboratory testing facilities to report their findings. Drug resistance makes infections that once required a straightforward course of antibiotics difficult to treat, requiring combinations of drugs over longer periods of time. And still, a multi-drug-resistant infection like tuberculosis carries with it a high risk of mortality. Patel says fighting antimicrobial resistance with new and better drugs is important, but a comprehensive approach is what's needed.
We need to have good infection control. We need to make sure that we're using antibiotics appropriately. We need good diagnostics in order to detect the resistance that occurs. So it's really this multi-pronged approach that's going to be effective. And just relying on the production of new drugs alone isn't going to do it.
Patel adds no country has been spared antibiotic resistance and, unless there's a global effort to contain it, the problem of drug failures will continue unabated. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
The UN says continued drought, insecurity, and disease outbreaks are worsening the humanitarian crisis in Somalia. It says overall 6.7 million people in Somalia are in need of assistance. More than 3 million are in what's called integrated phase classification. Phase 3 and 4, that means they are close to having famine declared, which is phase 5. About 714,000 people have been displaced by drought in Somalia since November. There are nearly 43,000 cases of acute watery diarrhea and cholera, and nearly 8,400 cases of measles. Vaccination campaigns are underway. Intense fighting in Maraka and Afgoi districts between May 21st and 24th led to the displacement of more than 15,000 people.
Coming up on 20 Minutes Past the Hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. There's grim news today about the status of pangolins, the extremely endangered scaly anteaters. Customs authorities in Hong Kong seized about 7 tons of pangolin scales this week. The animals are the most illegally trafficked mammal in the world. There are 8 species of African and Asian pangolins. The International Fund for Animal Welfare warns the pangolin could vanish for good. Mark Hofberg is the group's assistant campaigns officer. He spoke with Joe DiCampua about how many animals had to be killed to generate 7 tons of scales.
The best we can say is thousands. It came from Nigeria, the shipment, but we don't know if the actual animals came from Nigeria. It's a giant pangolin, which can be up to 30 to 40 kilograms, and some, like the black-bellied, are about 1 to 2 kilograms. So it's really hard to get an estimate of how many pangolins that is, but the average that we use, basically you say each ton is probably about 1,000 pangolins. But that is definitely a very rough estimate, so we don't like to put a number on it, but we can say thousands for sure.
Now, I know these animals are extremely endangered. When you see a seizure of this size, what does that mean for the animal?
It's frightening. This one is just huge. But we've seen this kind of scale of seizures over the past 4 or 5 years coming from Africa. And it's very frightening because these are solitary creatures. They don't run around in herds. So the fact that they're able to poach and traffic them at this scale just shows that before long, we could be looking at local extirpations or even entire extinctions.
Now, we hear about the attraction of ivory and rhino horns. What's the attraction for pangolin scales?
Like rhino horn, they're thought of as a medicine in traditional Chinese medicine. Pangolin scales are usually ground up into a powder and applied or imbibed for a variety of illnesses. The list is huge. It could be anywhere from like skin issues to aphrodisiac. There's no scientific evidence that it works because pangolin scale are basically made of keratin, which is the same substance as your fingernail. Obviously, there is a huge demand for it in that part of Asia. I will say, though, they're also used for certain cultural practices in Africa, in mostly southern Africa, but the scale usage for scales is much higher in Eastern Asia.
I understand there was a major confiscation in February in Thailand as well.
They seized about a ton of scales, and they came from the DRC by way of Kenya, and they were on their way to Vietnam.
How do you go about stopping this trafficking?
Good question. It's tough because by its nature, it's clandestine, so you can't just say, stop it. Last October at CITES, they voted to uplist all pangolin species to Appendix 1. Basically, you can't trade pangolins or their parts cross country lines for commercial purposes without very special circumstances, which is great. But as you can see, they're still getting through illegally. To answer your question, there's kind of 3 things that we talk about at IFAL that work to stop trafficking. One is reducing demand. That works by having demand reduction campaigns in China, in Vietnam, in Africa, to make people understand that buying these products, using these products, contributes to the decline of pangolins. The second prong is disrupting the trafficking. It's very important for customs officials to know what they're looking for and find it. The third prong is defending the areas where the pangolins live. So having wild spaces that are protected by rangers who know what they're doing and can find the poachers.
What's happening on the local level in Africa to deal with this problem?
So we found that in many of these countries, they have laws on the books that say you can't poach pangolins or you can't trade them. But they're not really enforced because, one, law enforcement officials really don't know about the law, or it's not seen as much of a crime, even though it's on the books. And two, a lot of the judicial officials don't know that as well. And so we found that if we educate the law enforcement and judiciary, then we see a lot more convictions and a lot more seizures. And therefore, it becomes an actual deterrent to poachers.
That's Mark Hofberg of the International Fund for Animal Welfare. He spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. This week, an issue familiar to women was highlighted during World Menstrual Hygiene Day. The average woman experiences her monthly cycle for 30 years of her life, but a staggering 1.2 billion women lack access to appropriate facilities to manage their periods safely and hygienically. In many countries, women fear assault and loss of dignity from having no private toilet facilities. When they miss work, school, or intentionally refrain from travel, they suffer economic loss for their families. I spoke with Chris Williams, the director of the UN organization, the Water Supply and Sanitation Collaborative Council. His organization has been working in countries such as Kenya, India, and Nepal to encourage changing attitudes on gender stereotypes and inequalities that still exist for women and girls.
Well, I think, like all adolescent girls in particular, they're going through a really intense transformation of their lives when a lot of things are happening at the same time. So even before we get to the actual physical aspect, there is a lot of transitions that are occurring in terms of identity, roles, responsibilities, relationships with other women, men, et cetera. It's a challenging time for adolescent girls anywhere. And then for women who are an older age for whom they've gone through that transition, menstrual hygiene is not something that is necessarily taken for granted. There are many constraints on women's mobility access due to the fact that both the social norms that are associated with menstruation are prohibitive in some locations, and also the facilities are not conducive for menstrual hygiene management.
And this would include them, in many cases, not being able to work or go to school or to travel, and just to really suffer not just economically, but also mentally as well.
I think the simplest way to say it is it's a restriction on mobility, and it's a refinement of one's actions in ways that are not the case when women are not menstruating.
What is the driver of this type of restriction on women and girls?
It's a combination of things. Part of it are social norms. Societal norms are entrenched over many generations that prohibit the movement of women, let's say, for example, going to school when they're menstruating, or even being in certain parts of the house or cooking, etc. There are also issues of the absence of basic facilities, which prevent women from, let's say, traveling, unable to take a journey at that time of the month, etc. So there's a combination of the absence of basic services as well as social norms that prohibit the movement.
On a physical level as well, they don't even have access to the necessary things that they need during that time of the month.
What people who are looking at this for the first time have to consider is to take a step back and look at the fact that for both men and women, there's an absence of basic sanitation facilities. There's over a billion people in the world that don't use any form of sanitation, and 2.4 billion who lack adequate sanitation. And this is both at the household level, but also in public spaces. So, for example, without menstruation, if a woman is seeking to travel long distance, there's no real place for her to go in the car park or the transport hub where she gets on transport. There's very few places for her to go along the way that are safe and secure. And then when she arrives in her destination, she has to also deal with the absence of that. So women literally have to develop a series of coping strategies to both travel and accommodate the absence of these facilities, such as not drinking, not eating, being very precise about when meals are had so that they don't, 10 or 12 hours later, have to relieve themselves in a place where that's absent. So it's an enormous constraint. And these coping strategies have all kinds of negative effects on sexual and reproductive health, on bodily functions, and on social norms.
What types of things are you doing to help improve this situation?
Well, I think the first step is to raise awareness. It's a taboo subject, and to sort of trigger discussion about it is an important first step. So we call it breaking the taboo. And that can happen within government at a policy level. It can involve groups of affected populations, women and girls, as well as older women who we document their experiences. It provides really good evidence for them to articulate for policy changes. So part of it is just breaking the silence and giving voice and agency to those that are affected. They're often not part of policy discussion or programming. Based on that, really get into discussions with government, get them much more concerned, policymakers at various levels and civil servants, have them be exposed to the issues, not only in the evidence being brought forth, but through systematic trainings that we do in this area to raise awareness, and then have that translate into both policy guidelines that can inform sanitation, education, and health policy across the spectrum, and then getting into creative programming and budgeting that reinforces that policy work. The last level is to really get grassroots in orientation and develop behavior change programming and support that in a number of governments so that millions of people can improve their sanitation and make sure that it's suitable for women, both in schools, at household levels, as well as public spaces.
Chris Williams is director of the United Nations organization, the Water Supply and Sanitation Collaborative Council. He spoke with me from Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.